second grade teacher gave a lesson on magnets, on what they were and how they worked. And then the next day, she gave a written test to the students, and there was a question on it that went like this. My full name has six letters. The first is M. I pick up things. What am I? And the teacher was surprised that when the papers were turned in, almost half the students wrote the word mother as the answer to that question instead of magnet. So thank you, moms. Your job is so often thankless and seems like it's never done. And sometimes I'm sure it feels like you only really get recognized for the things you do if something isn't done. So thank you for all of those things, for the hidden ways that you make a difference. Besides picking things up, another way that moms will make a difference and probably don't get the recognition they deserve for it is in answering questions. There was a UK survey that was done some time ago of 1,000 mothers, and it looked at the period of time during the day from breakfast until afternoon tea time. Remember, this was the UK. And so over that time, what they found is that stay-at-home moms get one question on average every 2 minutes and 36 seconds. If you do the math, that turns out to 105,120 questions a year. What they found is that the questions actually spike during mealtime, believe it or not, and that girls age 4 are the most curious and clock in at a high of 390 questions per day. On the other end of the spectrum, boys age 9 ask the fewest questions in a day. And the moms talked about what were the toughest questions that they got. Here were the top 5 questions, toughest questions that the moms reported in this survey. 1, why is water wet? 2, where does the sky end? 3, what are shadows made of? 4, why is the sky blue? And 5, how do fish breathe underwater? So apparently they're concerned about skies and water, especially. Well, it is appropriate on Mother's Day for us to talk about the subject of caregiving. Now, we continue in a series today called Go Deep. It's a series that it's a little different than most series that we do of sermons. We typically take a subject and then we go week by week through it. With this Go Deep series, what we're doing is we're doing it throughout the year. And so every 4 to 6 weeks, we come back to another sermon in this series because what we're talking about is the subject of spiritual pathways. 9 different ways that we can connect with God. Now, a couple things that are important to explain when we think about spiritual pathways. First of all, what we are not talking about is different pathways to salvation. I mean, we believe there is one way to salvation in Jesus Christ. What we're talking about is that when we come to God in Jesus, then there are these 9 different ways that we can connect with him, that we can grow in knowing him and in relating to him. And so we're talking about these 9 different ways, and the idea is that every one of us will tend to gravitate more toward one or two of the 9 than the others. And so we want to explore both what is the pathway or pathways that will most help us to grow in a relationship with God, each one of us. And what are some of the other ones that make a difference in people's lives that maybe are somewhat unfamiliar to us? And yet we'd have the opportunity to grow in those. Now, the thing is, all of the pathways I would suggest to you have aspects of them that every follower of Jesus should seek to include in their lives. So you don't necessarily get a pass if you say, well, that's not my pathway, so I don't have to do any of that stuff. We all have aspects of them that we will include in our lives, but we will have the opportunity to connect more with God and better with God with some of them more so than others. So we are on this Sunday in week 4 of the series. So we've talked about 3 of the 9 pathways before. Today we come to number 4. If you have been around for all or any of the other sermons, and maybe you've said to yourself, nope, haven't found it yet. Nope, definitely not that one. Not those. Then my encouragement to you is to wait and to keep listening and to keep coming back. But in the meantime, the reason that we have a 4 to 6 week gap between each sermon is that hopefully there is something from the sermon that you would say, whether it's my pathway or not, I could practice, I could give it a try, I could seek to include something from this pathway into my life, and maybe I'll find that I resonate more with it than I thought I would. Or maybe I'll find that, no, it's really not my thing, and yet there are still ways that I can grow as I include it in my life. One more thing, just by way of introduction. If you've been saying to yourself, you know, it would be really nice for me to know, like, maybe what my pathway was so that when I'm listening, I can pay attention a little better. We're going to make a survey available to you, and I'll make sure that we get it probably on Facebook and in the happenings email that we send out. There will be a little survey that you can take. And at the end, and I did it this past week, at the end of it, you can, you'll get a little report in your email that'll say, this is how you rank on all of the 9 pathways. And then you can sort of place yourself. And if you need to go back and listen to one that we've already heard, you can do that. Or as the sermons come up in the future, you can track along with them that way. So today, we are talking about what Gary Thomas, who wrote the book Sacred Pathways that we're basing the series on, we're going to talk about what he called the caregiving pathway. Or if you want kind of a simple definition of the caregiving pathway, it is loving God by loving others. Now, remember, I said there are aspects of every one of these pathways that every follower of Jesus needs to include. So if you say, loving others is not my pathway, sorry, you don't get a pass. Still got to love others. But for those of you that do resonate, you might find increasingly helpful ways to grow as you focus in this area. We see again and again through the scriptures this important idea of loving God by loving others. And we see it perhaps most clearly in Jesus. And so I'm going to take you to one text that I turn to often when we talk about loving God and loving others in Matthew chapter 22, and that's one of the gospel accounts of it. There are others as well. And in Matthew 22, it says, an expert in the law came to Jesus and tested him with this question, teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law? And Jesus replied, and some of you will know these words well. Jesus replied, love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your mind, this is the first and greatest commandment. And the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. Now, I love, there's a lot of things about this, these verses that I love. But the one thing that I love about it is what Jesus does here. He's asked a question. Now, what is the greatest commandment? So, Jesus, there's all of these commandments. Give us one. And Jesus, with, you know, ninja-like stealth, sneaks in a second one. He says, and the second, this is the first and greatest commandment, and the second is like it, love your neighbor as yourself. The implication is you can't do one without the other. You can't love God if you don't love your neighbor. Well, the Apostle John apparently learned from the best when it comes to this subject of loving God and loving others, because years later, after hearing Jesus say those words, he would write this in one of his letters, and we find this in 1 John chapter 4. He wrote, dear friends, since God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. That sounds kind of familiar. We love because he first loved us. Then he goes on, whoever claims to love God yet hates a brother or sister is a liar. For whoever does not love their brother and sister whom they have seen cannot love God whom they have not seen. And so what we have here really, I mean really, when it comes down to it, we're talking about an impossibility. It is impossible to love God without loving others. They are so deeply intertwined. You cannot separate them. You cannot love God if you do not love people that he's created. Now, once we accept that, if you accept that premise, okay, loving God, loving others, if we accept that idea, now there are all kinds of questions that we can wander into out of that. Well, who are others? I'm supposed to love others. Who are these others that I am supposed to love? And interestingly enough, there was a religious leader one day that asked Jesus a version of that question. And his form of the question was, who is my neighbor? I mean, if I'm supposed to love my neighbor, who is it? And Jesus goes into this elaborate story, and you can find the story in Luke chapter 10. He goes into this story about a man who was making a trip, and he was waylaid as he was traveling and was robbed and was beaten and left for dead along the road. And if you went to Sunday school as a kid, you know the story. Two people walk by, two very religious men walk by, a priest and a Levite. They walk by and they just keep on going. Jesus doesn't say why, what their reasons were, but apparently they had some reasons. They kept walking by, did not stop to help this man in the gutter. And then what happens is the least likely person of all does stop. And that person was a Samaritan. When you dig into the cultural background and history, you know that there was this deep-seated hostility, this animosity between the Jews and the Samaritans, racial tension between them, religious differences between them. Some of the most dividing forces in our society today had these Jews and Samaritans at odds, and it's a Samaritan that walks by this injured Jew. And when you read the story, it's amazing the lengths that he went to help him. And so the implication at the end of the story from Jesus is your neighbor or the other that you are supposed to love is the person right in front of you who needs your help. Whoever they are, wherever they're from, however like you or different from you they are, that's the one you love. And we ask, but what if they're my enemy? What if they hurt me? What if they created their own mess here? And the reason that they're in this situation, it is their fault. And yes, those are complexities for us to wrestle through when we talk about loving others, but the command is clear. Love others. Now, I said there's questions. You know, we can talk about who is the other, who is the neighbor. We can also talk about what does love actually mean? What does love look like? Well, interestingly, in the Christian faith, we see kind of an interesting way of expanding our understanding of love. So in historic Judaism, they would have followed what some have called the silver rule. The silver rule is basically the idea of do no harm. So don't do to someone else something that you would not want done to you. That's the silver rule. But, you know, that's kind of that doesn't necessarily help you know what to actually do. It maybe tells you some things not to do. Well, then Jesus introduces in his Sermon on the Mount what many of us would have learned is the golden rule. And that kind of flips the silver rule on its head. So do to others what you would want them to do to you. So instead of not doing certain things, you now do certain things. The things that you want done, that you wish someone would do for you, those are the things you do for someone else. That's the golden rule. Now, the interesting thing is that Jesus doesn't stop there. I mean, he offers the golden rule, which is more positive and proactive, but then he goes a step further. In John chapter 13, he introduces what some have called the platinum rule. You see the progression there, from silver to gold to platinum. And in John 13, we find this. Jesus to his disciples says, a new command I give you. Love one another. Now, wait a second, Jesus. That doesn't sound new. I think we've heard that one before. Continue. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples if you love one another. So now Jesus has taken it up another notch. Now the ultimate thing is not what you would want someone to do for you. You are not the standard anymore. The golden rule sets you up as, you know, what you want to do for others. Here Jesus says, now I say to you, my disciples, you love the way I, Jesus, have loved you. That's now your standard. That is what you're called to. And so John, his disciple, kind of, again, parses it out later on. And in 1 John 3, we find this. This is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us. And we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers and sisters. But he goes on and spells it out a little more. If anyone has material possessions and sees a brother or sister in need, but has no pity on them, how can the love of God be in that person? Dear children, let us not love with words or speech, but with actions and in truth. So what is love? What does love look like? Well, you might summarize it this way. Love isn't love unless it's lived. Love isn't love unless it's lived. How are you living out love? Well, you know, you can answer that question in all kinds of ways. You could answer it with 1 Corinthians 13, the text that Kim read for us earlier. That spells out some of the things that love is and does. I mean, you could go with what John says there, and you could say love is using your possessions for the good of another. You could say love is not only that, but it's laying down your life for others. Which for most of us, laying down our lives for someone else isn't something that we're going to do in one, you know, grand gesture of martyrdom. For most of us, laying down our life happens minute by minute, hour by hour, when we give our time, when we give our attention, when we give service to someone else, when we care for someone else. That is love. That is what we're called to. And you know, that is that kind of love, that kind of care that we've just walked through, that has really always been the hallmark of the faith of Christians at their best. Sociologist Rodney Stark looked into what is it that led to the spread of the Jesus movement? You know, from a small band of 120 people when Jesus ascended back into heaven to a worldwide movement that it is today. What led to the spread from those earliest, you know, tiny flickers of flame to when Christianity became the majority religion in the world? How did that happen? And Stark's observation was that the primary reason was the way that followers of Jesus responded to sick people. The way they responded to the sick people around them. And perfect example of that is in the early centuries of the church, probably the biggest sickness that Christians responded to was that of leprosy. And you know, if you've read the scriptures, then that's probably not a new term for you. Leprosy is a terrible skin disease that ultimately killed people. It would lead to isolation so that you don't infect other people. It led to impurity. Ultimately, it led to death. But Christians had an interesting response. In the 300s, about 300 years or so after Christ, a church father named Basil promoted caring for lepers by actually creating a place for them. And recognizing that the lepers themselves, they had no income, they'd have no way to pay for it, Basil said, well, we'll pay for it. I mean, we'll raise the money and we'll create this place, and at no cost to them, they'll be able to come and receive care. During that time, Basil's brother, a guy named Gregory, preached a sermon to raise money for it. And he said this in the sermon, famous sermon of the time. He wrote, "Lepers have been made in the image of God, in the same way you and I have, and perhaps preserve that image better than we. So let us take care of Christ while there is still time. Let us minister to Christ's needs. Let us give Christ nourishment. Let us clothe Christ. Let us gather Christ in. Let us show Christ honor." He was equating these suffering, leprous people and caring for them with caring for Jesus himself. And that was the beginning of what would come to be known as hospitals. In the Council of Nyssa, where, if you're a church history person, Council of Nyssa would have been where the Nicene Creed, one of the foundational creeds of the church, was adopted. At that same council, they also decreed that wherever a cathedral existed, there should also be a place to care for the sick and the poor. Just unheard of. I mean, for Romans at that time, I mean, they some of them had compassion, but they did not connect compassion to their gods. I mean, what their gods wanted was sacrificial offerings. They didn't care anything about charity. And then along come the Christians. And if a main reason that Christianity spread was because of the way that Christians cared for the sick and the poor. Gary Thomas also says that the spread of Jesus' message is a main reason that people today assume that religion and caring should be intricately interwoven. I mean, we just expect, if you're a religious person, I mean, you should probably be more loving and more caring. Why do we think that? I mean, most other religions don't preach that same kind of message. Well, it's because of the message of Jesus, that you cannot separate love for God and love for people. So that's the overview. I've done my best for those of you that say, well, loving others is probably not my pathway, to not let you wriggle off the hook. I mean, it's for all of us. But some of you will best connect with God by caring for others. For some of you, caring for other people is not a duty. It's not a responsibility. It's not a chore. It's a joy. It's a joy, and it just kind of flows out of you as part of your worship to God. You have a way of, if this is your pathway, you have a way of recognizing the image of God in a person that you're serving. And you're able to clearly connect serving that individual with worshiping the God who made that individual. If you feel closest to God when you are taking someone a meal, when you're visiting someone, when you're meeting a need, this might be your pathway. If you would rather do one of those things than sit in a church service or sing one more song, then that might be your pathway. If you wish that others would take the call to care for other people more seriously, and you can look and see all the ways that we could do it better, then this might be your pathway. So I want to suggest to you, in brief, some ways that, if this is your thing or not, some ways that you could incorporate this pathway into your life. And so I have a few suggestions for ways that you could grow as a caregiver, and then a couple things to beware if you're a caregiver. To grow as a caregiver, first of all, don't overlook the obvious. Don't overlook the obvious. So there may be people in your own family that need care. There may be people in your own house that need care. Sometimes we think that we have to go somewhere and do the big and the splashy thing to care for other people. But there might be people in your house, there might be people across your street. There probably are, actually. There might be people across town that need your care. And so, yes, you can do the big things when it comes to caring for other people, But make sure that doing the big things doesn't replace doing the small and the simple. So, volunteer, visit, repair, write, listen, accompany, drive, lend, read, research, teach, counsel, mow, babysit, bake, cook, give, shovel, clean. Don't overlook the obvious little things. Do those things. Secondly, ask God to help you see. Ask God to help you see. There's a story in Luke chapter 7. Jesus is eating at the home of a Pharisee named Simon, and a so-called sinful woman comes in and anoints Jesus' feet. And Adele Calhoun writes this about that story. She writes, when a neglectful religious leader passed judgment on a woman he didn't know, Jesus said to him, "Simon, do you see this woman?" Simon saw only appearances. He didn't feel for the woman because he did not see her. But Jesus really sees the hungry, the poor, the grieving, the physically impaired, the mentally deranged, the demonically oppressed, and the culturally marginalized. And what he sees moves him to compassion, to action, to healing, to restoration. Sometimes the biggest obstacle to caring for someone else is our lack of awareness of the need. Ask God to help you really see, to see the need around you. And the next one flows right out of that. Identify the outsiders in our community. Who is on the margins? Who are the people that seem to get missed or overlooked? Maybe, you know, ask a teacher, ask a healthcare worker, ask, you know, we have partners at Echoes in town. Ask them, who are the people that you think other people don't see? And then seek to learn from those people, not just to learn things about them, but to learn from them. And you may see ways that you can serve them. Fourth, consider how others have shown compassion to you. You know, cataloging key moments where someone has cared for you, where they made a difference for you, can sometimes open up your eyes to ways that you might care for someone else. And lastly, think about the needs of those who have served you. Sometimes we miss people that we depend on for something. And maybe we don't recognize that those people need someone to care for them too. And I already mentioned a few, you know, teachers, healthcare workers, restaurant servers. I mean, people that do something for us might be surprised in a good way to receive something from us, to receive care from us. Ways to grow. Now, two things to beware. Caregivers, beware judging those who don't care the way you do. If you are a natural caregiver sort, like if this pathway really resonates with you, then it's not too hard to be critical of someone who doesn't do it the way you do, or doesn't do it as often as you do, or doesn't do it where you do, or with whom you do. Now, we do need voices that remind those of us who don't do this as naturally of the needs around us. But we also have different callings, and so you can call people's attention to the need without also being critical of them and judging them. And then secondly, beware serving yourself by serving others. You know, sometimes people who are caregivers can be at an unhealthy spot of needing to be needed. and actually deriving worth out of the caring. And then it becomes more about what the server gets than the benefit to those being served. And then things can go sideways, and before long, you're not actually serving the people that you're trying to help anymore. One therapist said, "We do terrible things to people who already have enough problems without wanting them to also meet our own needs." So with those cautions and those encouragements, caring well is a great gift. It's a gift for the one being cared for. It's a gift for the one doing the caring. It's a way to experience God's presence and his power and to draw closer to him. And again, the call to do it is universal. But for some of you, you will find yourself growing closer to God in maybe surprising ways as you extend the care you've received from him to others. You'll connect with him more fully in those relationships than in any other way. So may God experience our love for him through the love that we show others. Would you pray with me? God, it's something we're so used to hearing if we're church people, the idea of loving you and loving others being so closely connected, that we might miss just how radical it is and how unique it is to Christianity, this call to love, and not just to love however we choose, but to love the way you, Jesus, have loved us. May we hear that call. May we love that way. And I pray for all of us, and especially for those who connect deeply with this pathway, that they would grow in profound ways in knowing you and in loving you, and in experiencing your presence and your power in their lives, and in offering you worship. May they grow as they extend care to those in need. Lord, we want to be available to you to be your hands and feet in the world. Would you love the world through us as we open ourselves to that? It's in your name, Jesus, I pray. Amen.